Okay, one of the things that we care about is how energy is transmitted, the rate of energy flow down a waveguide. And then also we'll be interested when we go to finite conductivity, a more realistic situation, instead of this idealized superconductor case I've been treating up to now. How fast does energy decay as it moves along the waveguide? That's, of course, really, really crucial in any physical application. So let's tackle those questions now. So the quantity we care most about is the time average rate of energy flow. Down the waveguide. And because we have complex fields here, if you recall back in chapter 6, the quantity we care about will be the time average pointing vector, which is the real part of 1/2 E across the complex conjugate of H. Right? You have to take one conjugated field, one unconjugated field, and we proved that the real part of 1/2 of their cross product will be the time average pointing vector. But now let me just go ahead and consider the complex pointing vector, and we'll then look at both the real and imaginary parts before throwing away the imaginary part. I'll call that the complex pointing vector, although I'll include the 1/2, anticipating that we will eventually take the time average. So let's look at 1/2 E cross into H star. And let's do this for a TM mode. Then we have S is 1/2. The full electric field has both a transverse and a Z component. Remember, when I write the vector over EZ, I'm including the unit vector, of course. Z hat is included. And then that's crossed into H conjugate, which you can refer to your sheet. Where is that on the sheet? That's, yeah, near the bottom. It's epsilon omega over k complex conjugate, and then z hat crossed e transverse conjugate. So you can see we're going to have two terms here. We have 1/2 epsilon omega over k conjugate e transverse crossed z hat cross e transverse conjugated. And then that's added to 1/2 epsilon omega over k conjugate Ez crossed into z hat crossed Et star. So from the back cab rule, this first term only has one component, namely, I guess I left out the unit vector in the notes. You might add that 1 half z hat epsilon omega over k star absolute value of Et squared. And the other term is minus 1 half epsilon omega over k conjugate the magnitude of Ez times Et conjugate. So let me collect all that into one formula. And this quantity I'm calling S, which is a half E cross H star, now looks like a half epsilon star omega star over k star. There's a part propagating along z, energy flow along z. That's actually what we care most about, as I'll show you in a minute. Then we have absolute value of k squared over gamma to the fourth. And the transverse gradient of Ez squared, and then that's minus ik star over gamma star squared Ez transverse gradient of Ez star. And so if we go to the limit where epsilon, omega, and k are all real, this simplifies this pointing vector to 1 half omega k epsilon for gamma to the fourth z hat del t of Ez squared. Plus I gamma squared over k Ez transverse gradient of Ez star. Which is the main result of that derivation. I think for the TE mode, maybe I'll spare you the algebra and just write the result. It's all on page 68, but it's just the same kind of algebra I just went through. You can go through that on your own. And I get STE mode is omega k over 2 gamma to the fourth. Part of the energy, again, in the z direction that we care most about, mu transverse gradient of hz squared minus I gamma squared mu over K HZ star transverse gradient of HZ. Let's see, I guess I have a little time to talk about this. Now, in fact, when we solved for psi, in both cases, remember this EZ or the HZ, that's what we called psi. That was our two-dimensional wave equation that we solved. That, it was solving a real partial differential equation with real boundary conditions in both cases, TE and TM. And so without any loss of generality, actually, we can choose those modes in for psi for either the TE or the TM case. We could actually choose it to be real. And as a result, you can see these second terms, which are would seem to represent energy flow at right angles to our waveguide propagation direction. This is the z-axis. These would seem to mean there's energy flow transverse. However, they are imaginary, and they disappear when we take the real part. So actually, there is no transverse energy flow. And there's only flow of energy down the waveguide. And we have now can quantify how fast that, or how, you know, what is the amount of energy flow in any given mode. Next time I'll actually work that out, because we will want to integrate that S dotted into the differential area. We'll want to add up all of the energy flow across this transverse cut, and then we can find the rate at which energy is totally going down the whole pipe. The time averaged power flow down a waveguide with perfectly conducting walls, call that P, the energy per second crossing any given point in the waveguide, would be the integral over the cross-sectional area of the pointing vector dotted into the z hat and integrated over the cross-sectional area of the waveguide. And so we can plug in the pointing vector that I think we already worked out for either TM or TE modes, and it looks like omega k over 2 gamma to the fourth, and then either epsilon for TM or mu for TE modes, and then times this integral, can write it as in terms of the transverse gradient of psi squared over the area. So again, for TM modes, you use epsilon. For TE modes, you use mu. And of course, for TM modes, psi is EZ. And for TE modes, psi is HZ. So So then we can keep going and work on this del psi squared here. Rewrite this in terms of using the Green's first identity, omega k over 2 gamma to the fourth, and again, epsilon or mu. And then rewrite that as a surface integral. This is a 2D Green's identity I'm using. Right, we're integrating over this area, and so the surface integral term is actually a line integral around the surface, which looks like integral around the circuit, psi star, the normal derivative of psi times the arc length around the loop, and then minus the area integral of psi star del transverse squared psi dA. And now for TM modes, psi is 0 on the boundary. For TE modes, d psi dN is 0. So in either case, this loop integral vanishes. And we're just left with this, but that is just minus gamma squared psi. And so we get a simpler expression for the integrated power across the cross-sectional area. Omega k over 2 gamma squared epsilon or mu. And the area integral of the absolute value of psi squared integrate over area. And this can in turn be simplified or rewritten a little more concretely using the various formulas, like k is root mu epsilon omega squared minus the cutoff frequency for mode lambda to the 1/2, and gamma squared is mu epsilon omega lambda squared, if you recall. And so we get the final formula, P is omega for 2 root mu epsilon 1 over omega lambda squared epsilon or mu for TM or TE modes. And now we've written everything in terms of simply the square of absolute square of psi integrated over the cross-sectional area. Okay, so this is how fast energy is flowing, energy per second down the cavity. Another quantity of interest is the time average energy of the fields inside the volume. If we pick a unit volume, we can calculate that. Because if we know an energy density and if we know the rate of power flow, we can find their ratio defines a velocity. You can think of a velocity of the energy flow, which is one of our goals here. Okay, so the focus on the time averaged energy per unit volume. This goes back to Jackson 6133 for a linear dielectric. If you remember, we had the energy per unit volume, electric energy, time averaged in terms of our complex fields. to find this. It's actually the would be the real part of that. And WM fourth B dot H conjugate. Again, real part of that. And so for real epsilon and mu, can write this as an energy per unit length inside the waveguide will be the integral dA of epsilon over 4 absolute E squared plus mu over 4 absolute H squared. And now we can rewrite that in terms of psi, the quantity we are focusing on in these derivations. So let me work this out explicitly in the TM case. I'll let you do on your own the TE case for practice. Which is a very similar derivation, a few extra twists though. Okay, so for the TM case, let's write the key relation for H, right? H transverse is epsilon omega over K z hat cross ET. I guess that's one of the formulas on our sheet. All right, that's near the bottom of the page of formulas I gave you. I don't remember the Jackson equation. And again, omega lambda squared is gamma lambda squared from solving the 2D Helmholtz equation for the allowed gamma values over mu epsilon. And k lambda squared, remind you, is mu epsilon times omega squared minus omega lambda squared. So the energy stored in a unit length of the cavity will be the transverse area integral, epsilon over 4, absolute value of ET squared. And the TM mode has an EZ component, has a longitudinal component, so let's include that. And then H only has a transverse component. And again, ET, maybe I'll put it up here, is IK over gamma squared transverse gradient of psi. And right, so HT is, could plug in that for there, but I won't write that. And of course, EZ is psi. Okay, so let's start putting all the pieces together. So the energy per unit length stored in the cavity, or waveguide, I should call it, dA epsilon over 4 psi squared plus epsilon over 4 gamma to the fourth for whichever mode we're calculating, and then absolute transverse gradient of psi squared, and then times 2k squared plus gamma squared. Just some algebra. And again, we can do the same Green's theorem trick that we did before. As I wrote in the notes, that gives a loop integral that vanishes, and a del squared term that we can replace by del squared psi, we can replace by minus gamma squared psi. And so this integral dA of transverse gradient of psi squared, after using that identity, becomes gamma squared absolute psi squared dA. Okay, so let me maybe just skip the rest of this exciting algebra and jump to the final result for TM modes, that the energy stored per unit length of the waveguide is the integral dA of epsilon over 2 omega squared over the squared cutoff frequency and psi squared. Right, and so that's for TM modes. And the exercise I'll give you to show for the TE modes gives the following formula. DU DL is mu over 2 omega squared over omega lambda squared integral dA, also the integral absolute psi squared. For TE. Okay, so we've derived two things that sound like they should have some connection. The average energy per second crossing any fixed cross-sectional area of the waveguide, which we derived before, called that the power P. And now we have the energy in a unit length. Okay, so we had an energy per time and an energy per length. And you could imagine the ratio of those will define a velocity. Okay. If I take the energy per time and divide it by the energy per length, that has dimensions of a velocity. We can interpret that as the speed of energy flow down the cavity. Waveguide. So that's, I claim P over du dl. And using our formula for TM modes, this is omega squared minus omega lambda squared to the 1/2 over omega squared root mu epsilon, which I can simplify to 1 over root mu epsilon 1 minus omega squared over omega lambda squared to the 1/2. But that's simply the group velocity we derived earlier. And so this makes sense, that the energy flows down the waveguide at just the exact same speed as a wave packet. If you make a Gaussian wave packet, send it down the waveguide, then the speed of the packet flowing is the same as the speed of the energy flow. Moreover, right, this is the speed of light in the cavity, which if it's mu naught and epsilon naught, it's the normal vacuum speed of light. Otherwise, it's like a modified local speed of light in the medium. But this quantity here is less than 1, the square root. And so find from this derivation that Vg is less than C, as we would like. We don't expect relativity to be consistent with any flow velocity of energy or information faster than the speed of light. And this does not violate that. Okay, so basically we've derived that the rate of power flow can be written as the energy density, energy per unit length, times the group velocity. Okay, any questions about that? It's all just like brain dead obvious. Except for the algebra, it might take a little thought.
The algebra is overwhelming, but I think
the basic logic.
Yeah.
Okay, so up to now we have almost everything we've done in Chapter 8 has been considering walls with infinite conductivity. And for a real metal like copper, say, the conductivity is high, but it's not infinite, and there are losses as the waveguide goes down a waveguide. And so that's a really crucial thing if you're going to ever work with waveguides. You want to know how fast energy is dissipated. And so now we'll generalize some of the arguments to calculate that rate of energy loss. And I'll allow the walls of the waveguide now to have a finite, but still rather high, conductivity. And the reason, this is a simple, comparatively simple limit to treat, because we can sort of view the solutions we've already derived as the correct zeroth order solutions. And then we can make use of some relations to find, then when we include the finiteness of the conductivity, how fast is the ohmic losses going to be building up. So in particular, I claim that for conductivity large, but less than infinity, our wave number for propagation, remember that's the value of k for a given individual mode that's moving down the waveguide in the z direction, that this should be approximately a zeroth order wave number that would be obtained for a perfect conductor. Plus, possibly, when we turn on the finiteness of the conductivity, bring it down to a finite number from infinity, there could be a small shift in the real part of K. But most importantly for our current interest is there will acquire in K an imaginary part that I'll write as I times a real number beta lambda, which I will assume is small, because the conductivity is assumed to be very high. So ohmic losses are not going to be, you know, very, very fast, but they will be there. And so we will make use of an energy conservation argument to derive this imaginary part. Once we know that, we will know how we'll see we'll have an exponential decay of this wave as it goes down, and we can translate that into the rate of energy loss. Okay, so from this expectation, we expect an exponential attenuation of the power, and in particular, we expect that the power going down the waveguide should have an exponential decay factor, like whatever was calculated at one point. If we go to a larger z, it should be smaller by e to the minus 2 beta lambda times z. And, well, actually, we expect that to be in either direction. Like if you go positive, it would be decay. If you go negative, of course, it would be decaying also. So maybe I should write, if I'm going to be careful, absolute value of z. But in most of this derivation, you can just think, we're thinking about waves going unidirectionally toward positive z. Yeah?
Is beta lambda always positive?
Well, of course, it wouldn't be for a laser. Right. If the medium is actually lasing, then you'll have actually growth. But for a normal wave that's not lasing, yeah, it would decay. Yeah. Oh, he asked, is beta lambda always positive? And I'm saying yes, basically, unless it's a medium that has gain, and the fields are going to actually grow from stimulated emission. Did you have a question? Oh, well, the fields are, the power is quadratic in the fields, right? So if the fields have this behavior, e to the minus beta lambda z, then they'll be squared in the power. Okay, so this means one way to calculate beta lambda would be from this formula, find the logarithmic derivative, basically, of the power as a function of z, and divide by 2. And that should be give us the crucial parameter that governs the exponential decay of power. But now we derived back in section 8.1 this quantity, the rate of power loss, into a wall that has finite conductivity. And so that's the key thing we need to use next. Any of you remember what that depended on? What did the... Yeah, of course it depends on conductivity. Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's what it ends up depending on, is essentially the parallel component of the H field at the surface. Because basically to have a parallel component of the H field, there had to be a surface current that would create that field and satisfy the boundary conditions. So you might review that if you don't remember much about that, because this is an important formula. But basically, from section 8.1, I'm claiming then that this minus dp dz will be 1 over twice sigma, this was one way of writing it, times the skin depth, and the loop integral around the circumference of the cross-sectional area of the waveguide, absolute value of n hat cross h squared dl. Right. And now that is also equal to this loop integral minus dp dA integral dl. So let's work this out more explicitly for the TM mode case, which is a little bit simpler. It's a little more complicated for the TE case, but I'll let you, again, I think it's good practice if you do some of these derivations yourself. So I suggest that you prove on your own the TE version of what I'm going to show now for the TM mode. Okay, so for a TM mode, Hz is 0, right? So again, we have our waveguide. And this loop we're talking about, of course, that's integrating around this loop bounding the cross-sectional area A. And now for TM mode, Hz is 0. And so n hat cross H will just equal n hat cross Ht for a TE mode. I'm sorry, for a TM mode. If you had a TE mode, you would have to also consider the n hat cross Hz. So that will give a second term in the case of a TE mode. But for TM mode, it's just n hat cross Ht, and we can also write that as then n hat cross z hat cross transverse gradient of psi squared and some constants, k squared over gamma fourth, epsilon squared, omega squared over k squared. Right, and so this and this n hat cross z hat cross, this becomes z hat times n hat dot transverse gradient of psi, which is also, we just write that as d psi dn, the normal derivative of psi. So let me spare you the rest of that algebra. And give the simple form. There's a little more intermediate steps in the notes, but I don't think you really want me to go through every algebra step. So finally, this gives minus dp dz for a TM mode as this 1 over 2 sigma delta, and then omega squared for mu squared omega lambda fourth, and then the loop integral of the absolute value of the normal derivative of psi squared integrated around the loop dl. Okay, so And let me write the TE formula, which is also in the notes, that will be your mission to derive in your vast spare time 1 over 2 sigma delta omega squared over omega lambda squared. Now we have two loop integrals. The first looks like 1 over mu epsilon omega lambda squared, 1 minus omega lambda squared over omega squared. And then n hat cross the transverse gradient of psi squared. And then a second term, omega lambda squared over omega squared absolute psi squared dl. For the TE case, you get this second term. Okay, so all this only is really assuming that the losses are fairly slow. The exponential decay is you know, going to preserve for some appreciable length of time down the waveguide before it dissipates away. But one of the things to check this, which is useful, is to find roughly the orders of magnitude involved, which I wanted to go through next. Some order of the magnitude estimates, which also gives an exact formula, but in terms of a dimensionless constant that you, if you don't know anything else about a waveguide, you can sort of assume it's of the order of unity. Okay, so let's try to make this estimate. So the concept of this is to basically estimate the order of magnitude of the transverse derivatives in this formula for the TM mode. Again, let's focus on that for now. Basically, what we're going to do to estimate that is to appeal back to the 2D Helmholtz equation, transverse gradient or Laplacian plus mu epsilon omega lambda squared psi is zero. And so now here is our rough estimate. Let's take the the average value of d psi dn squared here to be roughly mu epsilon omega lambda squared, the average value of psi squared. Right, since these are equal, that's probably not a totally crazy hypothesis for thinking of order of magnitude scale here. And so that is also approximately the average of n hat, the normal crossed into delta del transverse of psi squared. And so this integral that we need to estimate include these factors, 1 over omega lambda squared d psi dn squared dl. Its order of magnitude should be something like mu epsilon times the circumference should come in, right, circumference of our cross-sectional area from this integral, and then times something like the average of psi squared. And if we write out the average of psi squared more concretely, it'll be mu epsilon c over the area divided by the area integral of psi squared. That's just writing out the expectation value, or the average of psi squared more explicitly. And again, c is the circumference. Okay, so that is pretty much the basis of the argument. There's just one other thing that is normally done at this point, which is to use this idea about how the circumference and area come into this to actually recast the loss formula as an exact expression for a dimensionless constant that's going to be, we expect, probably of the order of unity. Okay, it might be 3, but anyway, it's not going to be 10 to the 7. So let's call this constant C lambda. Okay, it's going to be mode dependent, of course, but we expect it's of order 1, and it's defined as follows. C lambda is defined to be the loop integral around the circumference of omega lambda squared d psi dn squared, the loop integral, divided by this cross-sectional area integral, mu epsilon c over a, the area integral of psi squared dA. So that's the number that we'll probably, if we don't know anything else and we don't want to work out these integrals, we want to get a rough idea, we will probably set that to 1 for estimation purposes. But if you actually know the fields, you can actually calculate this explicitly. Okay, and so then from the TM formulas for dpdz, which I guess I've erased, maybe I should rewrite it, dptmdz, 1 over 2 sigma delta omega squared over mu squared omega lambda fourth integral d psi dn squared dl, and p, which we said was omega for 2 root mu epsilon omega lambda squared times this factor, omega squared minus omega lambda squared to the 1/2, and then b epsilon for TM or mu for TE modes, the area integral of psi squared dA. So putting that together in the formula we derived for beta lambda gives this formula for a TM mode. Again, minus 1 over 2 p dp dz should be epsilon over mu to the 1/2, 1 over sigma delta lambda, circumference over twice the area, omega over omega lambda to the 1/2, over square root 1 minus omega lambda squared over omega squared to the 1 half, and then times c lambda. And now in this form, this is an exact formula within this slow decay approximation, high conductivity approximation. And now we have an expression in terms of this dimensionless constant, which can be calculated in principle explicitly. But if you don't have time or you're making rough kind of back of the envelope estimates when you're designing your waveguide, you can set it to 1 and get a rough idea. Right. Let's see. I mean, we derived this formula for dp dz directly, and it only involves psi at one point. You know, there. I mean, of course, psi does carry along and e to the ikz, but that drops out of this absolute square. Right, so we calculated the mode for a given cross-sectional area, right? So now you have to do an area integral for that mode function that was calculated. And now for the circumference integral, you take those fields and you integrate around C. You aren't actually integrating along Z. This is an instantaneous log derivative of the power at this point using the fields at this point. So when I go further downstream, of course, the fields at this point will be smaller already, but right, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, this gives the rate. I mean, once you know beta lambda, then the whole power will go like this: power at some first point times e minus twice beta lambda z. Oh, yeah. I guess that's right. But it's going to be common in the numerator and denominator, right? So this beta won't be z dependent, but these are decaying, both the numerator and the denominator.
There's not one in the real conductor case, but maybe the perfect conductor case, but now
there is. Right.
Can you say again some things about this assumption?
What did we assume? Okay, so again, this argument about getting an order of magnitude was actually mostly used to motivate this final exact form of beta. But to kind of identify the order of magnitude, we used this argument which led us to this formula for this dimensionless constant, which if we don't know anything else, we'll set to 1. So again, about the only other approximation we're making is that conductivity is high. The skin depth is rather small. I guess that's about it. Again, in this formula, again, which is just for TM, I should write the formula for TE, which again, you might want to derive yourselves for practice. Is that enough about that, or did you want to hear some more?
When we say we're focusing on the order of magnitude for the derivative, okay, but I guess in more physical terms, we need to compare
Right. How fast is the power decreasing as you change in Z? And of course, that depends on the conductivity. That'll be zero if conductivity is infinite. Things are a little more complicated for the TE case. And the main point is that where we have a xi lambda for the TM modes, this gets modified to two terms. There is a xi lambda. And then there is a frequency-dependent term as well with a second dimensionless constant of order unity that Jackson, I think, calls eta lambda. And it's also dimensionless. Okay, but I'm not going to work that case out. But let's see what some real numbers are for some kind of real microwave sort of typical frequencies. As an example, let's take a microwave oven frequency. These are always, I think, something like omega would be 2 pi times the frequency in hertz, which I believe is 2.5 gigahertz for every microwave oven. Do you know why? Why is it 2.5 gigahertz? What's the reason that's chosen?
The reason for the microwave to work itself is to be in resonance with those water molecules. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I forget, is it a vibrational frequency of the water, I believe? Yeah. Okay, so then if we also use a typical metal conductivity, sigma, something like 6, 10 to the 7th, inverse ohms, inverse meters. If we take the magnetic permeability in the conductor to be approximately the vacuum permeability, 4 pi 10 to the minus 7th in SI units, Newton per ampere squared. And so for those numbers, the skin depth, you can work out on your own, works out to be root 2 over mu omega sigma is like 1.3 microns. Okay. So if we take a cross-sectional radius, like a centimeter, call that R, 1 centimeter. Okay, let's convert to SI units, 0.01 meter. And let's take a frequency which is of the order of the Baer frequency times root 3. I don't remember why that was chosen. Anyway, plug in the numbers, you get beta is of the following order of magnitude, epsilon over mu to the 1/2, 1 over sigma delta, 2 pi r if it's a circular cross section, and over the area, twice the area, 2 pi r squared, 3 to the 1/4 over 2/3 to the 1/2. Then this gives 0.005 inverse meters. And so by this estimate, the power is going to decay by a factor 1 over E. Over a distance in the longitudinal direction of the order of 100 meters, basically. And Jackson went through this estimate. He seemed to get a slightly different number, 200 to 400 meters. Okay. What else? Oh, yeah, the frequency dependence I wanted to say a few words about. So let's scope out the kind of topology of the big picture, how these frequency dependence looks for these losses. And in particular, can see from our formula, which I guess no longer exists on the board, that if you look at the formula we wrote for beta, you can see that in the high frequency limit, beta is growing like square root of omega. But also, when you get omega near a cutoff frequency, it gets very large. And if beta gets real large, right, if you're starting to have really huge losses such that you just have to go a very tiny distance and you've lost all the energy, then basically our whole approximation scheme fails. So keep that in mind if you have to work in those regimes. But if you sketch what this beta lambda looks like versus frequency, usually it's plotted as beta lambda versus omega for a given mode versus omega over the cutoff frequency. And somewhere on this graph would be 1, right? You only get propagating waves for omega larger than omega lambda. And you get a divergence. If you really come down with omega to the cutoff frequency, the losses get infinitely fast. So you have kind of a graph like this with a minimum for TM modes, which is always at, in fact, this root 3 that I used in this derivation. Now, TE modes, on the other hand, have this more complicated dependence depending on two separate constants. And so the TE modes have a minimum which there's no simple formula for where the minimum loss for a TE mode is, it really depends on both of these roughly order unity constants. But for TM, it's always at this root 3, this special value root 3. So there are more accurate ways of doing the calculation. Jackson introduces one that I think he calls perturbation of boundary conditions, which is introduced in section 8.6 that I don't want to go through, but if you're interested, you might read through that yourself. There's also, if you're really interested, you might look up Schwinger's work that he did during World War II. He did a lot of theory of microwaves, and he introduced a variational principle, in fact, specifically for calculations like you have a little obstruction in a waveguide. How does that affect your losses? And the Schwinger variational principle, well, we use it even in quantum mechanics nowadays to do scattering calculations. It's a pretty useful tool. But he first introduced it, I think, in this context of microwaves when they were trying to improve radar so they could keep the German submarines from sinking all the boats. Okay. Any questions about that?